And tonight, because they are organized the way they are, I want to just read each one of them and comment on each one of them as we deal with them, rather than reading a long section. By way of introduction, let me say that we are going to look in this chapter tonight at a whole series of various precepts, laws, commandments, and statutes, which to our way of thinking seems to be kind of a jumbled up thing as far as organization is concerned. And I believe this is because we are inclined to regard life as having various well-organized departments, and that these various slices of the pie of life have very little to do with each other. There's the world of business and of the home and of the community and so on. But I believe that in the biblical world and life view, this kind of compartmentalization just was not a part of their thinking. And so everything was looked upon as a part of the life that the children of Israel were to live before the face of God. And I believe that this is the organizing principle. You'll notice in this chapter that the phrase, "I, the Lord, am your God," or "I am the Lord your God," appears seven times. Please look at chapter 19, verse 3. You see the end there? "I am the Lord your God." Verse 4, "I am the Lord your God." Verse 9 and 10 ends again with, "I am the Lord your God." And then in similar manner, verse 25, 31, 34, and 36. But that's not all. "I am the Lord" appears eight times. Look at verse 12. "I am the Lord." Verse 14, "I am the Lord." And 16, 18, 28, 30, 32, and 37. So the idea here is that God is saying over and over again, "I am the Lord, do this. I am the Lord, your God, do that. I am the Lord," and so on, right through this whole section. And it is because the Lord is our God that He calls upon us to do all these things. Now, the master concept is stated in verse 1. "The Lord said to Moses, 'Speak to the entire assembly of Israel and say to them, be holy, because I, the Lord your God, am holy.'" Now, that's a tremendously important statement, and it really states the regulative principle of the entire passage. It suggests, in terms of what follows it, that all of life must be subject to the sanctification of the Lord. Putting it a different way, the Israelites are here reminded that at all times and in all activities, no compartments, they are to bear in mind both their privilege and obligation. And what is that privilege? It is to be the Lord's people. And what is the obligation? It is to be like the Lord, because the Lord is holy, therefore they are also to be holy. It's very significant to me that in the New Testament the same is also taught in its New Testament coloring. Look at Ephesians chapter 5, verse 1, and you'll see this. Therefore, be followers of God as dear children, and walk in love as Christ also has loved, and so on. So you have there the New Testament counterpart of this very same idea. Look also at Matthew 5, verse 48, in the Sermon on the Mount, right after Christ has himself given a lot of these moral precepts, he says in verse 48, "You shall therefore be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect." So, it's not a different emphasis in the New Testament. It's simply that in the New Testament, we come out of the realm of shadows into the light of the full day of God's grace. And so what you have is that regulative idea, the entire assembly, meaning the entire body of the people of God, they belong to the Lord, and because they belong to the Lord, they are to be like the Lord. That's the essence of the calling of Israel as the messianic people. And then follows, from verse 3 to the end of the chapter, a whole series of precepts and commandments. And you may remember that it is from this chapter that one of the precepts that summarizes the law is quoted. Namely, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." That comes out of this chapter. And that's in verse 18. And so this chapter is of the utmost importance. It must be, if Christ, when he summarizes the law of God and says all of the law and prophets rests on these two precepts, and he selects one out of this passage must itself be of the utmost importance. Now what we have then is a variation in the presentation of the content of the Ten Commandments. Let us look then at some of these particular laws. First of all, what does it mean, "Be holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy"? The Hebrew word is kadosh, and it means fundamentally separateness and uniqueness. God is separate from everything else because he is different from everything else and utterly unique. It's an interesting phenomenon and strange to us that some of the cult prostitutes of the Canaanite religion were also called by this word kadosh. I noticed that when I was a seminary student, and that really was perplexing to me, that the word that signifies the set-apartness of God and his people is kadosh, and the word for these cult prostitutes of the Canaanites. The reason for that is that the fundamental root idea of it is someone set apart totally for that service to another. And the one is, you might say, the very negative opposite of the other, both share that one characteristic thoroughly, being set apart unto the service of this other. But God is set apart as unique, and his people are to be set apart totally unto him as unique, and so the set apartness of God and his people comes to have, through the revelation of God in the Bible and through the practices which he permits and the practices which he doesn't permit, it comes to be filled with the content that we know of as holiness. And the The thing that we need to see in this chapter is that the holiness that God requires of His people, the being set apart and different from the world, the pagan world around them, just as God is different from the pagan idols, involves the whole of life, not just a part of it. Religion is not an ingredient added to the rest of life, but it is the entirety of life set apart in a unique way to God. Now, verse 3, we come to the first one, and the first one here is the fifth commandment and the fourth commandment in the Decalogue. Each of you must respect his mother and father, and you must observe my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God. Now, there's two things strike you there, I hope. One of them is the fact that the first commandment mentioned in this series is the fifth. And the second thing is the fact that the mother is mentioned before the father. And I think both are very significant. If you look in your New Testament at the book of Ephesians for a minute again, I'll point out something to you there that has given some difficulty to people. In Ephesians chapter 6, we read in the first verse, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth." That has perplexed Bible commentators because there is another commandment in the Decalogue before this one that contains a promise, and that is the second commandment, where God says He will visit the sins of the fathers, the iniquities of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation, but showing mercy to thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. There's a promise. How can it therefore say here that this is the first commandment with promise? Two possibilities. One possibility is that it is the first commandment with promise in the life of God's covenant people. In other words, God's covenant people first come into contact with His authority through their parents. That makes entirely good sense. It is consistent with the Bible. That may be the meaning. The other possibility is that in saying this, Paul was thinking of just such a passage as we're looking at here. I'll leave you to decide if you have a preference for one of those. But in any event, the fact that in this instance the mother is mentioned before the father, to my mind, clearly establishes that in the fifth commandment there is an equality as far as parental authority over children is concerned. There is a headship of the husband as regards the wife, but as far as the parents as over against the children, they stand together as one authority. And that is probably why, in this instance, the mother is mentioned before the father. Just to underline the fact that this is a dual and mutually equal authority that father and mother have as over against the children. No child has any more right to disobey mother than to disobey father. And there ought to be no opportunity to play one off against the other, and so on. The second thing that we notice here is the word for observe. By the way, the word here in the first part of that verse is the word respect or fear instead of the word honor, and I think that just intensifies the idea. But the second thing here is the fact that the word In the Decalogue is, remember the Sabbath day. Here the word is, observe the Sabbath day. And is that an important additional light upon it? Yes, it is. Someone has put it like this. The Hebrew word translated here by observe, samar, is really the word remember put into action. In other words, this is letting us know that remembering the Sabbath day, that's right, that's a primary emphasis, but that's not all. We not only have to remember it, but we have to carry out the implications of that remembering in actually observing it. And little nuances like this are really quite illuminating as we study these precepts. Now the fourth verse says, don't turn to idols or make gods of cast metal for yourselves. I am the Lord your God. There two of the Ten Commandments are commented on. The first one is, do not turn to non-entities. Vanities is the literal translation of the Hebrew word there. And vanities in the Bible means things that have no reality to them. There's no substance to them. They are unreal. And that's really what the false gods were. The idol gods of the ancient world were always looked upon in the Bible as non-entities, having no substantial reality behind them. And so the first part of this commandment, or this precept rather, reiterates the first commandment, but with the additional idea that these, you shall have no other gods before me. The idea is that these other gods are non-entities. There's nothing there, really. And that's a tremendously important insight. The second part of the commandment is that you are not to make Elohim, that is the standard biblical word for the God of Israel, the God of the Bible, or make Elohim of cast metal for yourselves. In other words, the second commandment. You're not only not to have a non-entity as your God, but you're not even to try to fashion some kind of a representation of the true God, because that also is forbidden by Almighty God as a desecration of His entitled worship and reverence. Now in verses 5 through 8, you have a reference to the fellowship offerings that we dealt with at some length, or the peace offering that we dealt with before in an earlier chapter. And to some people, this is a rather a jarring thing to have right in the midst of these precepts, which in effect repeat the Ten Commandments, the great summary of the moral law of God, to have these ceremonial laws brought in here. But I point out to you that in that period of redemptive history, these ceremonial laws prescribed the manner in which God was to be worshipped. So what you really have in verses 5 through 8 is a further elaboration of the second commandment. The second commandment says you shall not make unto yourselves any graven image or any likeness of anything in heaven above or the earth beneath or the water under the earth. You shall not make for yourself is the key idea. Well, that's exactly what is at stake here. When you sacrifice, sacrifice in such a way that it will be accepted. It's the how you're doing it that is at stake here. And that's what the second commandment is all about. The second commandment is the guardian of the purity of worship of the people of God. How are we to worship God? Our catechism says, well, only as God commands. Not the way you want, but the way He wants. Not do your own thing, but be very sure you do His thing. And that's exactly what is at stake here. I don't think any other part of this requires comment, except that they were to eat it by the third day. The reason for that, in my judgment, is to safeguard the worship aspect of it from being profaned in the direction of something common. Let me put it this way. If they did not consume the food soon after the offering was made to the Lord, one could almost begin to feel that the purpose of the sacrifice was to provide food for this week or whatever. And that, you see, would be an inversion of the meaning of it. No, the food aspect of it was very much secondary. The primary thing was the bringing of the offering to Jehovah and worshiping Him through it and by means of it. Therefore, the Lord did not allow them to prolong it and make it really a means of providing food for the food basket. All right, number 9 and 10. When you reap the harvest of your land, don't reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Don't go over your vineyard a second time or pick up the grapes that have fallen. Leave them for the poor and the alien. I am the Lord your God. Now, I regard this as an implication of the sixth commandment, you shall not kill. We are told in the New Testament that if you don't love your brother, you are a murderer. In other words, the opposite of kill is love. And this is a manifestation of love for brother. You leave something there for those less fortunate than you because you love your brother. You leave them for the poor and the alien because you love your neighbor as you love yourself. And so you really have here an implication of the sixth commandment. Some commentators think that this had its origin in pagan background, where some of the ancient people left gifts for the spirits in the fields because they were thought to be an endangering of their harvests and things of that kind. I don't know. That's a possibility, I suppose. I remember Minka Hanskamp, our New Zealand missionary that was martyred out in Thailand, talking about the enormous problem of fear of demons and the people being in bondage to the demonic and making offerings to them and so on for everything under the sun that they did in their social life and business life and all the rest of it. So this is a possibility. But you can see that the way God regulates it, it is definitely not an offering. It is not an offering to a spirit. It is an act of compassion and concern for the poor. Verses 9 through 11 deal with various commandments of the second table of the law. Don't steal, don't lie, don't deceive a man, his countryman, is the way it is literally in the Hebrew. Do not deceive a man, his countryman. Do not bear falsely by my name and so profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. All of these have to do with some false dealing with others. And it all is so clearly related to those particular commandments that very little comment is needed. one could say that the person who does these things is concerned only about himself and not about his neighbor and not about his God, but beyond that, they do not add anything that I can see of great significance to those commandments. They simply remind these children of Israel that all of these are concern of God and that they are to live in these areas too, to his honor and glory. In verse 13 we read, "Do not defraud your neighbor or rob him." The word defraud is translated by some of the translations by the word oppress, and probably does have the idea of injustice perpetrated by force behind it. Now, the word defraud doesn't have that idea of force in it so much as the original does. And the word rob is also really to grab or seize by force. So there is here clearly an emphasis on the use of force in doing harm to your neighbor. The second precept is, don't hold back the wages of a hired man overnight. This is commented on in Matthew 20 in one of the parables of Jesus, as you know. But in ancient times, this was looked upon even among the children of Israel as sometimes a bit too strict. And the Talmud, which was a sort of uninspired commentary that began to take on more authority than the Bible sometimes, it allowed an employer to delay payment of the wages as late as the following morning. I don't see any justification for that, but that's what they did. However, some of the ancient rabbis did have some very clear insight into the heart of this precept. They took it to be also a prohibition by good and necessary inference, by logical inference from this. They took it to be a prohibition also of giving misleading advice to ignorant persons, of any attempt to get a person with a Nazirite vow to drink wine while he was under that vow. They saw that as a violation of this precept. And they, interestingly enough, applied it also as a prohibition against selling lethal or dangerous weapons to children. And that's, I think, a legitimate, logical thing that one could infer from this. Now, verse 14, "Do not curse the deaf or put a stumbling block in front of the blind, but fear your God, I am the Lord." Interesting to notice there that pronouncing a curse on a deaf person who can't hear it is put on the same level as causing a blind person to stumble because he can't see that you're putting this stumbling block in front of him. And you can see here the tremendous concern of the living God for compassion, mercy, and justice. In verse 15 we read, "Do not pervert justice, do not show partiality to the poor or favoritism to the great, but judge your neighbor fairly." This concerned the public administration of justice clearly, and it was as over against the customs of that day an amazing contrast, because other societies in that period of world history definitely took into account social position in the administration of justice. If you were higher up in social position, then the law tended to be lenient. If you were lower down, it tended to be more severe. And the congregation of God and the people amongst the people of God, there was to be no deviation from justice, whether out of feelings of sympathy for the lowly, or fear or ingratiation, the desire to ingratiate oneself with regard to the rich and powerful. There must be one law faithfully administered without respect of persons. Verse 16, don't go about spreading slander among your people. Don't do anything that endangers your neighbor's life. I am the Lord. That last one is a very interesting one. It almost states the general principle that our catechism has itself deduced from the sixth commandment. Don't do anything that endangers your neighbor's life. The Hebrew word here translated spreading slander is related to a verb which is used in Hebrew language to describe the work of a traveling merchant. What it really refers to then is a person who kind of makes it his business to spread slander and scandalous gossip. And it's interesting that a person who makes it his business to spread ugly gossip about others is here spoken of in the same breath with one who endangers a neighbor's life. As you know, the Hebrews loved a kind of parallelism. They always said one thing and then another after it that was parallel to it. And you can see that structure right through these things that we're looking at. And in this one, spreading this slander as a kind of a merchant of bad news about other people is kind of equated here with the one who does something to endanger his neighbor's life. What a tremendous insight into the wickedness of that evil. Verses 17 and 18, don't hate your brother in your heart. Rebuke your neighbor frankly so you will not share in his guilt. Don't seek revenge or bear a grudge against one of your people, but love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. Now, the thing that makes that quite unique as far as the Old Testament is concerned is that it deals with the heart. And it's therefore not surprising that out of all of the Old Testament case law material and all that, here is the one our Lord seized upon as distilling the essence of the law of God. Because it really does. It deals with the heart out of which all the other stuff comes. The thoughts, the words, and the deeds. And you'll also notice here that it is strikingly parallel to Matthew 18. If you'll turn to Matthew 18, just remind you, without reading it all, remind you of the parallelism. Now in Matthew 18, Christ is the speaker. He is teaching his disciples. And in that passage, he gives the parable of the lost sheep. And I think that's been generally recognized as an unequaled picture of the loving concern of the Lord for his people, and that's the model for us. And right after having shown us this tremendous picture of the love of the Savior for his erring children, the wandering sheep, he starts this instruction about how we are to deal with our brother. 15, moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault, and so on. If he hears you, you have gained your brother, and so on. So it's in the context of a self-sacrificing love that will drive a good shepherd out in a stormy night in the cold to rescue that erring sheep. It's in the context of love at its maximum that we have this instruction of Christ: if your brother sins, go and tell him, and so on. Well, that's so close to what is stated here. Don't hate your brother in your heart. Love him as you love yourself. But what do you do to carry out that love? It's really striking. Don't hate your brother in your heart. Rebuke your neighbor frankly so you will not share his guilt. In other words, if your brother or your sister sins and you love them, you go to them and you confront them and you deal with that sin. That does not fit the modern day definition of love. The modern day definition of love is to avoid confrontation and say nothing and let it go and keep in your heart, in your own mind, the thought, boy, what a sinner. That's the modern idea of love. The biblical idea of love is you love that person enough that you care for them enough to do the hard thing and go to them, confront them, and tell them. And it's all right here in Leviticus in the Old Testament. All right. Now, verse 19. Keep my decrees. Don't make different kinds of animals. Don't plant your field with two kinds of seed. Don't wear clothing woven of two kinds of materials. The Bible commentators down through the centuries have had difficulty with this. Why does it say this? And was this a moral principle binding under all circumstances or not? Well, you know, I'm sure, that mules became rather common amongst the people of God and were not looked upon as wrong. Look at 2 Samuel 13:29. So the servants of Absalom did to Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons arose, and each one got on his mule and fled. Chapter 18, verse 9 of the same book, 18, verse 9, reads, "Then Absalom met the servants of David. Absalom rode on a mule. The mule went under the thick boughs of a great terebinth tree," and so on. 1 Kings 1, 33. The king also said to them, "Take with you the servants of your Lord, and have Solomon my son ride on my own mule, and take him down to Gihon. There let Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet anoint him king over Israel and blow the horn." So you can see that mules came to be common in Israel in the days of the greatest of the kings of Israel, David and Solomon. It would appear then that there is substance to the comments of an ancient Hebrew commentator by the name of Maimonides, who said that the prohibition regarding the clothing was based on the fact that idolatrous priests of the Canaanite nations attempted to perform sorcery by working fabrics taken from plants and animals into their garments. And he was suspicious that there was a religious background to these commandments, and some modern commentators think that this is probably correct. The prohibitions against cultivating two products in the same field, cross-breeding animals, and making clothing from two types of material, all of these were probably related to the thought that every kind of plant and animal had its own kind or life principle that they were not to tamper with. And some of the things you read about hybridization makes you wonder if in the long run it is not going to be rather destructive. I heard not so long ago on this that they are running out of new materials to use to keep the hybrid process going, because in times they seem to wear out, and so they are always looking around the world for some species or strain of a plant that has never been used in a hybridization formula to try to rejuvenate that and produce these superabundant materials. What I'm saying, and you probably don't have to have me tell you, is that we really don't know exactly for sure what lay behind these particular precepts. Now verses 20 to 22. If a man sleeps with a woman who is a slave girl promised to another man, but who has not yet been ransomed or given her freedom, there must be due punishment. Yet they are not to be put to death because she had not been freed. The man, however, must bring a ram to the entrance to the tent of meeting for a guilt offering to the Lord. With the ram of the guilt offering, the priest is to make atonement for him before the Lord for the sin he has committed, and his sin will be forgiven. The sleep with here really in the Hebrew means to have sex with. And the term which is used here and translated due punishment is a term that only appears once in the entire Old Testament. And whenever you run into that problem, it's what we call a hapax legomenon, a word that only appears once in Scripture, then you really have some difficulty in knowing exactly what it means, because you don't have much context to tell you. But some regard this as probably meaning some type of scourging or whipping, and that may be true. For example, Ibn Ezra, an ancient Hebrew commentator, maintained that the word meant ox whip, and thus thought that the physical punishment was severe. Not death, but severe. But it does show you that this woman, not having been free, but a slave, changed the circumstances so that the requirement of Deuteronomy 22, 23, and 24 did not apply. We'll read that. We'll have to stop with that for tonight, I guess. But Deuteronomy 22, 23, and 24. If a young woman, a virgin, is betrothed to a husband, and a man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out of the gate of that city, and you shall stone them to death with stones. The young woman, because she did not cry out in the city, and the man, because he humbled his neighbor's wife, so you shall put away the evil person from among you. That did not apply if the woman was a slave and the man was a free Israelite. Well, I had hoped to cover this chapter, but we'll have to leave it there for tonight. Come back next time to verse 23. of chapter 19.